Recording is ready, so we can proceed. If you will call the second case, please, we will get going.
The court will now call Rainier South Lake GSC et al. Versus Blueberry Strategic Partners et al. The Mason Court, Mr. Michael Hutchins, the Honorable for the appellant, and Mr. Max Staines, the Honorable for the appellant.
Good morning, Mr. Hutchins.
Good morning. May it please the court. As was just announced, I'm Michael Hutchins, and I represent the appellants. Now, for ease of reference in this argument, I'm going to refer to the appellants collectively as Rainier and to the appellees collectively as Woodbury. There are numerous issues to cover here today, so I'm not going to go into a detailed recitation of the facts. Those are thoroughly briefed in our original brief, but I do want to give the court a brief overview. Rainier is a Delaware statutory trust. It's also called a DST, and that's a form of a legal tax shelter. People don't like to use those words, but that's what it is. Now, Rainier's assets consisted of a commercial real estate portfolio in Southlake. It struggled to meet its debt obligations following the 2008 meltdown, and so it partnered with Woodbury to inject sufficient capital to resolve the loan obligation, to rehabilitate the property so it could ultimately be sold at a profit. Now, after working together over a period of months to acquire the note on the property, Woodbury, without notifying Rainier that it intended to cut Rainier out of the arrangement, purchased the note for its own use. Rainier filed suit alleging a couple of things, but primarily at issue here, breach of fiduciary duty arising out of a partnership and breach of contract.
Do you agree that if there's no partnership, all the rest of the claims fail?
I do not agree, Your Honor. A partnership and a breach of contract have separate and distinct elements. Now, the trial court granted summary judgment in favor of Woodbury on all claims, so all evidence favorable to Rainier must be taken as true, and every inference must be indulged in Rainier's favor. And Rainier prevails on this appeal if there's some evidence in the record to support the elements of its claims. And we submit there is ample evidence here. The primary dispute in this case is whether the parties formed a partnership. And the test for whether a partnership is formed is clear. There are five factors outlined in the Business Organizations Code. You've got the receipt or right to receive a share of profits in the business. Number two, you've got expression of intent to be partners in the business. Number three, you've got participation in control of the business. Four, you've got agreement to share losses of the business. And five, you've got an agreement to contribute money or property to the business. It's important to realize that no single factor is either necessary or sufficient to prove the existence of a partnership. And instead, the Supreme Court has given us guidelines on what to do with this five-factor test. The Supreme Court in Ingram versus Deere said the court must apply a totality of the circumstances test. And that test is very fact-specific, but it's also very broad. It also does not require a formal agreement for a partnership. Most important in this matter, the totality of the circumstances test differs significantly from the test for contract formation. And the record here contains evidence of three of these five factors, and that is sufficient to demonstrate a genuine issue of material fact under the totality of the circumstances test. First, we have evidence the parties expressed an intent to be partners in the business. Now, in analyzing this factor, the case law tells us that context is important, and that's understandable because you don't want to go down to a restaurant with your friend, refer to them publicly as your partner, and be stuck in a partnership. But we don't have casual references here. Instead, we have multiple uses of the word partnership in a significant context. We've got the term sheet that explicitly identifies the party's relationship as partnership in four places. It talks about governance of the partnership, and it uses that specific word going forward. It specifies the type of legal entity that will contain the partnership. It assigns the right to control the partnership, And it says the term sheet will become part of the document of the partnership documentation. The context of the term sheet shows this use of the word partnership was anything but casual. Consider this. It was drafted by Woodbury's agent, QCC, in conjunction with Woodbury. It was on QCC's letterhead, and it was a carefully considered document. And Woodbury's agent instructed Rainier to share this document with the third-party lender. Now, under the El Paso Court of Appeals case in Brewer versus Big Lake State Bank, which is cited in our brief, and which the Supreme Court cited with approval in Ingram, a party's use of the term partner in introducing another party to a bank is evidence of the existence of a partnership. That's because the context in talking to your banker is significant. And Woodbury's representative, Daniel Woodbury, also acknowledged the existence of the partnership in his deposition. When he was asked about the party's options following the foreclosure sale, he stated, there could have been a new partnership with Rainier directly for Southlake. So if we're looking for context, sworn testimony using the term partner in a dispute over whether a partnership existed is significant context.
Would you please address the appellee's argument that Rainier rejected the proposed term sheet by a counteroffer?
Well, as a preliminary matter on the rejection argument, there's no need. The rejection is a contract principle. There's no need to prove whether there was a rejection or an acceptance under the totality of the circumstances test. Additionally, there is evidence that the terms in the email that were discussed that Rainier sent back to Mr. Schulke, there is evidence that those terms, even if we're looking under contract elements, those terms were not material. So Mr. Cross, Rainier's representative, testified at length about that, and that testimony is in the record. Under the totality of the circumstances test, you don't have to have a formal agreement. You don't have to have it. The five factors in totality of the circumstances test allows a partnership to be formed even if there is a technical failure with some kind of formal documentation.
But it doesn't allow a partnership to be formed if the parties are saying to one party, you're a partner, and to another party, you're not a partner.
I don't believe that occurred in this case, Your Honor. That's actually disputed. With all due respect, that's disputed testimony. Woodbury relies extensively on testimony from the lender claiming that Rainier was saying that there was no partnership. That testimony was thoroughly repudiated by Rainier's representative. And actually, that testimony is block quoted in our reply brief. So, and that was an issue at the summary judgment hearing, because the primary ground or the primary argument that Woodbury made at the summary judgment in their motion was that Rainier was so terrible, and it was primarily based on this testimony from Mr. Paul Martin from Midland Capital. But it was clearly contradicted. So that is a fact issue as to whether that occurred. So back to the issue of rejection, there is no requirement that there was a formal acceptance. And we also have evidence that even if there was, the parties resolved those differences and continued to work under the terms of that term sheet going forward. We've got an email on the record from Mr. Schulke months after the alleged rejection, in which he said to Mr. Cross, he said that now that we've gone from a discounted payoff to a loan sale, we need to consider whether we should update the term sheet. Well, if Mr. Schulke was so concerned about there being a rejection, you would either see something in the record where he said there is no agreement. You wouldn't have evidence where he's talking about the term sheet and operating under the terms of the term sheet. You wouldn't have evidence in the record where Mr. Schulke and Woodbury were continuing to pump Rainier for information, working toward the ultimate goal of acquiring that note. That's all evidence that there actually wasn't a rejection, even if contract principles apply.
Mr. Hutchins, in reference to the term sheet, there's a place on the first page that at the bottom under the heading in the center of terms, there's a capitalized partnership, colon, on the left-hand side of a column. And then it references on that same line, a single-purpose limited liability company. What was the name of this proposed limited, single-purpose limited liability company?
Your Honor, the parties did not reach the point where they actually formed that single-purpose LLC.
I didn't ask you if they formed it. I just asked you if there was even a name associated with any kind of company like that.
They had not selected a name.
Didn't pick a name. So they didn't pick a name, didn't pick a company, never organized a company, but yet your concern, your position is, in spite of that, this term sheet evidenced a line of sufficient evidence under the totality of the circumstances these parties were involved in that there was a partnership formed.
Yes, Your Honor, that is our position. And in fact, if you look at that, the term sheet does not say we will form a partnership once we form an LLC. The use of a single purpose LLC is a common thing, especially in real estate.
And I'm familiar with that, and I'm not arguing that. I think lots of people decide after they decide they're going to have a partnership to go set up the structure of the partnership and end up with a limited liability company, perhaps as the general partner, many, many times. See that all the time. But that didn't happen here because under your term sheet, you were setting out, here's the way we're going to do business in this go forward. And you never got to the point of even having a limited liability company discussed from the record that I could see.
Well, Justice Meyer, the term sheet doesn't precondition the formation of a partnership on the creation of an LLC. It's a next step in the partnership. There's no preconditional language in there. It doesn't say we have to form an LLC and then we will have a partnership. There are a number of additional steps to be taken, and you can form a partnership without actually having the legal entity, liability shielding legal entity formed. Now, if the term sheet had said something different and had said that is a precondition, or we have to form an LLC, which as you are aware is a relatively simple step, and there is nothing under the totality of the circumstances test that requires you to pick a name for your entity. In fact, Woodbury did actually go forward and eventually form the LLC, possibly pursuant to the partnership. They selected a name out of the blue at the end. I'd submit that selecting a name for the eventual LLC and the actual technical formation are not preconditions for the formation.
There's so many things about an LLC that are not directly related to the partnership function of trying to figure out how you're going to do business together, share profits, get involved with the operation of the business. I mean, the mere concept that we're going to have a partnership and it's going to be function as a single purpose limited liability company, to me, opens a myriad of questions as to how control operation everyday business is going to be conducted.
Well, Your Honor, but those points were actually addressed in the term sheet. So what we have evidence of the sharing of profits. We have evidence of who's going to control. We have evidence of how the parties are going to manage the property. So all of those things that would eventually get rolled into an LLC, they're actually present, and they're in the term sheet.
Thank you, sir.
So what we have is we've got an agreement also to contribute money and property. There's evidence in the term sheet. There's evidence in the testimony of that factor. And I do want to address very quickly at least one of Woodbury's cases that they cite. They rely on Haas versus Alderman for the proposition that simple deposition testimony of the 50-50 profit split without more explanation provides no evidence to support the profit-sharing factor. Actually, Haas held the opposite, and the Citroen Holdings versus Minnis case also held the opposite. It said that simple testimony of profit-sharing is enough to create a fact issue on profit sharing. And remember, that's what we're dealing with here. We're just looking for fact issues on these elements. So what we've got is we've got a record that has significant evidence to demonstrate sharing of profits with parties who meaningfully and consistently referred to themselves as partners, and we have partners who agreed to contribute money or property to the partnership. And under the totality of the circumstances case, and in a summary judgment context, we have enough evidence here to show that the court erred in granting summary judgment on those claims. Thank you.
May it please the court. The record in this case does not support Rainier's attempts to transform an unfinished business deal into a legal partnership by surprise. The term sheet that he's referred to and that he's admitted, his corporate representative has admitted, is the entirety of the material terms of the alleged partnership, is unenforceable for several reasons. First, there's no acceptance in strict compliance with the offer. The offer was made at Clerk's Record 79, and it said acceptance must be delivered directly to QCC in a fully executed version of the contract. It's undisputed they never did that. And in fact, we didn't see that version until a deposition when it was produced to us, months and months and months later. Under Justice Meyer's decision in Gibb, there's no agreement here as a matter of law. But even if you look at Clerk's Record 80, which he referred to, I urge you and your clerks to do this. Read Clerk's Record 80 and see if you think that's an acceptance. See if you think it's a counteroffer, because it most definitely is a counteroffer. In fact, all it says is we're going to advance this term sheet onto the loan servicer. It doesn't even say I accepted the offer and let's move forward. It says I've forwarded the signed version to keep the ball moving. And we have things we need to finalize, I'm quoting now, before it's in final form to sign. I've attached comments and changes. One of those changes was a red line to the disposition fee, which was 1% of the total alleged contract, the alleged partnership agreement. That's a $140,000 material term that they've told you in the briefs was not material. They simply say it in conclusory fashion. They cite some deposition testimony, and they say it, magically it is so, but it is not. That's a material term. Also, that email, that same email that they say is the acceptance, had a property management agreement attached to it that was unsigned, that had blanks, and he was asking him, let's negotiate that. 15-page long property management agreement. Now, I want to touch on something that opposing counsel said. First, I want to touch on something that Justice Meyer questioned him about. There's no question that other essential terms were left open for future negotiation here. The proposed term sheet is an agreement to agree. If you look at it, it actually says we plan to agree on an LLC in the future. And then the term that you touched on, Justice Meyer, is absolutely positively contemplating a different legal entity than a partnership. It's contemplating an LLC. We know from this record it's undisputed that the parties took no steps to form the LLC. They hadn't even begun negotiating how they were going to govern this relationship, who was going to be in what positions, who was going to control the property management and the like. There's testimony that's unrefuted that says at Clerk's Record 271, the transaction could not close until the LLC was formed. Rainier says that there's a fact issue because their corporate rep says those were non-essential terms. That's a legal question for you to decide if the LLC is a material term or not under these circumstances. Just because he offers his conclusory lay opinion on that doesn't make it so. The parties agreed to reach a future agreement on an LLC that would govern and control the parties' relationship. Clearly an essential term here. We also can look to their objective conduct after they say there was a partnership agreement formed. And I'm going to point you to documents from them and from Carlin, this other lender. I'm not going to point you to testimony. Rainier secretly sought more favorable terms from another lender after they say that we were their partner. At Clerk's Record 123 through 127, you'll see documents that show they were negotiating a completely separate deal for a loan, with Carlin. Carlin in no way had any contact with Woodbury. There's nothing in the record suggesting otherwise. They were not part of our deal, and if you look at those places in the clerk's record, you'll see it's clear they could not be a part of our deal. Also, if you look at clerk's record 160, he said a bit about the Paul Martin testimony was refuted by Sean Cross. He didn't mention that Paul Martin took contemporaneous notes of his phone calls with Mr. Cross. Those are in the record at clerk's record 160. And it shows that they were telling Midland, the loan servicer, that the terms were not agreeable with Woodbury. And now I ask you, how do you have a breach of contract or a partnership if that alleged document hasn't been signed and you're telling other lenders, I want to do a deal with you, and you're telling the loan servicer that those terms are not agreeable and they're not the one? Let me touch on the partnership factors briefly. This continuum that the Supreme Court described in Ingram says something about the totality of the circumstances test that's important here, because they've conceded to you that two of these factors don't even apply. They have no evidence of them. So we're left with the other three. The Supreme Court has said if you have zero, then obviously there's no partnership. They said if you just have one, there's no partnership. Other cases interpreting Ingram have said if you have just two, there's no partnership. So they have to hit all three. They have to bat 1,000 on the three that they've put in front of you. I first want to talk about the intent to form a partnership. Obviously, if they rejected by counteroffer, they never accepted or showed any intent to form a partnership. That's conclusive evidence of no intent on their part. Their conduct that we just discussed with Carlin, telling Midland that we're not the one, those are documented, conclusory pieces of evidence that show they had no intent to enter into a partnership with us. And I'm using their own words in documents. He hit on one thing that I think is his strongest argument, and that is that the term sheet, if you believe it was accepted, uses the word partnership four different times. But as Justice Meyer pointed out, the term, how it defined a partnership, was a future LLC. And even more importantly, if you look at the Ingram case, Ingram versus Deere, at page 900, it says that's not sufficient because of the reasons Mr. Hutchins detailed for you. The use of the word partner is used in so many contexts that there must be more than just the use of a word to bind people to the obligations and legal responsibilities. And so I urge you to look at the Ingram decision when you evaluate his argument in that regard. And of course, how can there be intent to form a partnership when the actual intent of the proposed term sheet was to form an LLC? Two legally different entities altogether. The agreement to contribute money is the next factor I want to touch on. And again, because Rainier rejected the proposed term sheet, nobody agreed to contribute anything. Rainier actually contributed nothing to this business transaction. They were trying to avoid foreclosure. We were going to invest all the capital in an LLC that would buy the note, that would keep them from foreclosure. So in their briefing, what do they tell you they contributed? Well, they could tell you they contributed confidential information and their expertise. I beg you to look at the term sheet and see if that's what the parties agreed to. I think you'll find what I did, which is there's no mention of confidential information anywhere in the proposed term sheet. The same term sheet that they told you was the agreement. They also offer no explanation as to how this alleged confidential information added any value to the alleged partnership. As a matter of law, they can't meet that factor either. There was certainly no agreement to split profits as co-owners. They point you to a provision in the proposed term sheet that says there'll be a 60-40 split at the back end. But I'd like to describe what else the proposed term sheet sets up. And of course, we go back to the same argument to destroy this factor as we have the others. There was no agreement because they rejected it and they counteroffered. So how could we agree to split profits when there was no agreement? The term sheet in its details actually sets forth a pretty complex capital return fee compensation structure. Woodbury gets 100% of the revenues of this proposed business, 15% rate of return until we're fully restored, which could take years. We get a management fee of $75,000 a year. We get an acquisition fee of 3% on the note, and Rainier gets a 1% disposition fee on the back end. That is not a true profit-sharing arrangement between co-owners of a business. And again, what was the business going to look like? We don't know because the parties never got there. I'd like to touch just for a moment on this notion that we that the trial court erred in granting summary judgment on the contract claims. Woodbury's motion for summary judgment without question attacked the alleged partnership and its unenforceability. Rainier's response joined issue with that. The trial court granted summary judgment on all claims. No one objected, no one specially accepted to anybody's motion. Regardless, even if you believe that somehow our motion could be construed as not raising the breach of contract claims and their unenforceability, that error is harmless because the omitted ground is intertwined with the arguments that were made for the fiduciary duty claim. In other words, we alleged the partnership agreement that they say was the proposed term sheet was unenforceable. That's the same ground for the breach of contract. And under this court's opinion in Krakauer and the Supreme Court in McGee, any error they've alleged in that regard is harmless. If the court has any further questions, I'll yield my time. Thank you.
May I please the court? Well, we clearly have a difference of opinion on partnership and contract law. And as you heard counsel argue, almost exclusively on contract law, a brief reference to totality of the circumstances test. The problem with contract law is it simply does not control here. Those are different elements. Now, when we talk about acceptance, Mr. Cross testified that all of those differences that he had in his email were eventually resolved. So that is evidence that there was a meeting of the minds, even if we required it. We also have evidence that the parties operated under that term sheet. Now, Woodbury has no way of explaining why they continued to pump Rainier for information to obtain the loan, why they did that without saying, hey, we have no deal. To understand that, you have to think that Woodbury was understanding that Rainier was just cutting its own throat, knowingly doing that. Yet Woodbury stood silent. But it didn't just stand silent. It said, we need more information because we need to get the right price on the loan. That's in the emails. It's also in the testimony that Woodbury relied on that information to get the loan. You also have the email from Star Schulke to Woodbury after they had acquired the note saying, hey, the borrowers is calling me like crazy. I think that this is simple. You need to live up to the spirit of the original agreement. That is evidence from Woodbury's own agent that there, in fact, was an agreement. Now, if we're looking for objective conduct, those things are objective. If we're looking for disputed conduct, the entire Carlin Capital issue, as I addressed before, although the appellees continue to rely on it, the entire Carlin Capital testimony that Rainier was working behind the scenes against the deal, that is all disputed. We're talking about a summary judgment issue here. Now, on the agreement to contribute.
Mr. Hutchins, what was to be the relationship between Kirvin and your client?
I'm sorry?
What was being discussed as the relationship between Kirvin and
your client?
Was it a partnership or was it an other form of business?
No, our client testified that it was additional financing. It was additional financing for the deal.
Except we want to make a deal with you to provide us additional money, and here's the terms of what we want to do with you in exchange for you providing additional money.
Well, and there was also testimony from Mr. Cross that he talked to Woodbury's agent about that, and the terms for the additional financing weren't favorable, so they moved forward.
So there was no deal with them?
There was no deal. It was just a discussion about additional financing. But I want to talk about the agreement to contribute money or property of value. They say that there's no agreement to contribute confidential information. I think that there's adequate record evidence in the record that there is. But if you look at the term sheet, at the beginning of the term sheet, it says that Rainier brought the deal to the table. That in and of itself is an agreement to contribute something of value. But for Rainier bringing that to the table, Woodbury would have had nothing. On the MSJ issue, it's their burden to raise to raise it in the MSJ. Now, they say that the arguments are intertwined, but that's not the test in Krakenauer. The test is whether the elements of the claims are intertwined. And you do not need a contract to form a partnership, and you do not need a partnership to form a contract. So if you've got an MSJ that only has one of those aren't common elements. Those aren't common legal elements. And that's what the court's decision in Krakenauer said. Thank you. I'll cede the rest of my time.
Thank you. Counsel, thank you very much for your arguments here today. We appreciate them. And your case is submitted. You are free to go about your business, and we will remain seated for one more oral argument.